Thank you. Thank you for the very kind invitation. You know you're in the right place when the opening prayer gets a standing ovation. That's the kind of people you want to hang with. Thank you. I'm kind of at an age right now where I've made the same New Year's resolution every day, every year for the last 15 years, mainly because I can't seem to keep this one. So the resolution that I've made over and over again is that I would lose a little bit of weight, get a little more fit. So for 15 years, I've made this resolution. So I said, this year, I'm going to take it seriously. I'm going to do what a professor does and what a teacher does, which is to research the topic. So I go online and I look up what is the best exercise program that will keep you fit and healthy. And I found out it's something called CrossFit. And if you know what that's about, CrossFit, P90X. Now, I don't do it, but I appreciate the philosophy behind CrossFit. The philosophy of CrossFit is something called muscle confusion, which has been my approach to exercise my entire life. The way I've applied it is I don't go to the gym for months and months and months, and when I finally go to the gym, my muscles are really confused why we're there. So sometimes, if we want physical fitness, it's okay to have a little bit of confusion. It's okay to disrupt our status quo. And I would also argue that if you want spiritual fullness and well-being and fitness, it's okay to experience a little bit of confusion. It's okay to experience a little bit of disruption. I just finished about a year ago, after 5 years of work, a commentary on the Book of Lamentations. And as my wife so brilliantly points out, you work 5 years on this book, you're going to sell about 5 copies of this book because nobody wants a book on Lamentations. Who's going to buy a book on Lamentations? Well, the reason I wanted to bring this book to the Christian community is because we are not engaging in the themes around lament and Lamentations. So there was a study done among liturgical churches in the United States. These would be the Catholic churches, the Anglican churches, Lutheran churches, etc., that are given guidelines on what you're supposed to preach, what you're supposed to read, and what songs and hymns you're supposed to sing. Turns out that even the liturgical places where you're supposed to go through the lament psalms at some point, they just skip over it when it comes to that time. So when it comes time to lament, they say, well, it's kind of a downer to look at the lament psalms, so we're just going to skip it. There was another study done with Baptist and Presbyterian hymnals. And Glenn Pemberton looked at the hymnals and he said, if you look at the psalms, which was the worship hymnal for the people of Israel, you would notice that 60% of those 150 psalms are psalms of praise, which talk about all the good things that God has done. And 40% of those psalms are psalms of lament, which talk about suffering and pain. But if you look at the typical Baptist or Presbyterian hymnal, you'll only find that about 15% of those hymnals qualify as lament hymns, and the rest are praise hymns. And that's just what's in the hymns and not even what we sing on a typical Sunday. So I used the same idea and I applied it to something called the CCLI license. Some of you know what that is. Whenever you project a contemporary worship song on the screen, there's a little number at the bottom, CCLI number, about 7 to 8 digits. And every time you sing that worship song, contemporary song, you're supposed to keep a record and then you send that number or you send the songs you sang to the headquarters of CCLI. So they actually keep a record of the most popular worship songs in the American church. So every year around this time, actually in August, they produce the top 100 worship songs, contemporary worship songs, that are sung in your typical American church. So how many of you say, just like in the Bible, 40% of our contemporary worship songs are songs of lament? 40%. How about 25%? Do I hear 20% or 15% or 10%? I guess I'm working through all the song lyrics of these top 100 songs. I think about 5 to 10 of those songs are lament songs in the contemporary worship songs. And that's using the word lament in the most generous ways that I can think of. The song starts out, I cry out, finally, lament song. Rest of it is I cry out for joy. No, I still have to count it. This is so pathetic how few of these songs are lament songs. So we're dealing with a community of believers here, particularly in America and particularly in the West, that does not understand how to lament, how to deal with suffering and pain. And what we do is we gloss over it, we skip over it, we leave it out, and we don't know how to deal with the stories of suffering and pain. And I would argue it's one of the reasons our understanding of urban ministry, social justice, and racial justice and reconciliation is oftentimes so anemic, because we're missing the important discipline of lament. So tonight I want to introduce you to the discipline of lament through the book of Lamentations. I'm going to read verses 1 through 3 in chapter 1. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she who was once great among the nations. She who was queen among the provinces now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers there is no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. After affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. She dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. So we're seeing the context of why Lamentations needs to be written. As many of you know, this is after the fall of Jerusalem. Jerusalem and Israel had once been this great nation, this great capital city. But because of their disobedience, God brings judgment upon the people of God, and he sends them into exile, as this passage reminds us. And as they're sent away into exile, and the most able body, the intelligentsia, the prophet, the priests, and the kings are taken away into exile. Of course, we know the story of Daniel and his friends. In other words, the ones that the Babylonians thought could rebuild that society was sent away into exile. And the ones that were left behind in Jerusalem were the women, the children, the orphans, the widows, the poor, the sick, the lame, and the blind. And those who the Babylonians said, there's no way this group could rebuild that society. So we're dealing with a people that are completely devastated and crushed because of this exile. So you see that in verse 3, that after affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. But when you look at the next, when we think about the context here of this broken community, this city that has been devastated, this great nation that has now been laid waste, there are three potential responses that we're going to deal with. The first potential response is to run away and hide. And the second potential response is to give in to the world around them. And the third response is the appropriate response, which is to enter into a season of lament. I'm going to go over all three of these to say, how is it that God's people engage in the first two, and why we're called to do something different? The first response, disengage with the world and run away, that challenge is addressed in Jeremiah 29, verses 4 and following. Passage that most of us are familiar with. We've read through this, especially in urban ministry. This is what the Lord Almighty says to those who I sent into exile: build houses, settle down, marry, have children, give them into marriage, and increase in number there, do not decrease. Verse 7 is the passage most of us are familiar with. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Now, most of you know that almost every other circumstance in the Old Testament, when you see the phrase, seek the peace, what city is usually spoken of? Jerusalem. Consistently. One or two exceptions. This is one of the few exceptions where it says, not seek the peace of Jerusalem, but seek the peace of which city? Babylon. Of all cities, to say you are now responsible to seek the peace of, why Babylon? Because we know the biblical account. Repeatedly, Jerusalem is the heavenly city, the holy city, the righteous city, the city of David, and Babylon is the center of all that is wrong with the world. It's the city of God, Jerusalem, versus the city of Satan and paganism and Baal worship and all that is wrong, the city of Babylon. And yet God says, I've sent you into Babylon, and even in the midst of the most wicked city in the world, you are not allowed to run away and hide. You are not allowed to give up. No matter what our circumstances are around us, God's people, we do not have the option of running away and hiding. You've got options. That's not one of them. You cannot run away and hide when there are difficult circumstances around you. Now, I raise this because, unfortunately, the history of the church in America has indicated that when difficulties arise, when changes occur, the church has oftentimes run away. Here's one of the examples in the 19th and 20th century. The cities were considered to be Jerusalems. They were considered to be the possible places where the gospel would go forth, the places where God would send forth his army and send forth his missionaries. But until what happened in the 19th century? Black folks showed up in the city. Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans showed up in the city. Latinos showed up in the city. Even Asian folks started showing up in the city. So the city was no longer the city set on a hill. New Jerusalem, New Zions. What did the cities become in the 19th and 20th century? Babylon. Cities are Babylon. Cities are wicked and evil places. Cities are places filled with these strange people from different shores. Cities are filled with black folks migrating from the south, Eastern Europeans, Asians. It's a strange place to be. So what did most white Anglo-Saxon Protestants do with the city? They fled, white flight, left the city in droves, started churches out in the suburbs, started Christian colleges out in the suburbs, moved all the denominational headquarters out into the suburbs because they were afraid of what was going on in the city. The city was no longer safe. It was Babylon. And so you see this transition, this movement away from the city, fleeing to the suburbs. Now, one of the ways that's been most indicative is church buildings. In 1945, $20 million total in the United States was spent on new church buildings. At the height of this white flight movement post-World War II, by 1960, $1 billion was being spent on new church buildings in America. Why is that? That's a huge jump. That's an exponential jump. How do you go from $20 million nationally spent on buildings to $1 billion spent on new buildings by 1960? Why? Because people were leaving the city and building new buildings in the suburbs. White flight, that also meant whites leaving the city into the suburbs. Now, one of the things that I noticed is that the church buildings that were starting in the suburbs, many of the sanctuaries look like the next slide. Those of you who are from the Midwest, you'll notice that a lot of the buildings, if we can put the next slide up, sanctuaries look like this, with a slanted roof and a little bit of an arch on the side. Very typical. How many of you have seen church buildings built like this? In the 1950s, 1960s, almost every church building, especially here in the Midwest, are built like that. Now, I was at a building dedication in 1975, and we had just finished a building, a sanctuary that looked like this. And I'm about 10 years old, and I'm looking at this building saying, this is a really bad idea. This is the stupidest design for a building I have ever seen. Whose idea was it to build this stupid building? Why was it stupid? I was in a cold weather state. The heating vents are on the floor. The heat comes into the building. Where does it all go? Right up into the rafters. And so you literally have the frozen chosen on the floor and then all the air up in the rafters. So what do? You have to build ceiling fans to push the hot air down, and then charismatics won't worship with you because they hit their hands on the ceiling fans when they're trying to worship. So you're dealing with a church building that makes zero sense. I'm saying, whose idea was this? And the pastor gets up, and he says, it was my idea to build a building like this. I said, why? And he said, I want you to imagine the entire church building turned upside down. And what would it look like to you if the church building were turned upside down? And he said, it's a bottom of a boat. It's a giant ship. Our church is a giant boat. Now, where in the Bible do you read about a really big boat? Noah's Ark. Now, what are you saying to the world when your church is Noah's Ark? You don't care about the world out there. Let them be destroyed and judged and let them be flooded. As long as we're safe in Noah's Ark. We don't trust the secular world, so we're going to build a little Christian microcosm of the world. And here on Noah's Ark, we're going to have architecture that reflects this Noah's Ark, and we're also going to have Christian music instead of secular music. Christian art instead of secular art. Christian coloring books instead of secular coloring books. Christian underwear, Christian makeup. You name it, we've got a Christian version of it here on the Ark because we're afraid of the world out there. Let them be destroyed as long as we're safe on Noah's Ark. Now, here's part of the problem, though. How do you do evangelism from an Ark? Not very well. Here's what happens. Uncle Joe floats by. Oh, we love Uncle Joe. He's family. Let's throw out a little life raft, bring him on board. Uncle Joe, we're so glad you're here. You're going to fit right in into the culture of this ark. But then your neighbor floats by. And you say, oh, wait a minute. He borrowed my mower a week ago, and he hasn't given it back yet. I don't know if he's going to fit on this ark. Because on this ark, we clap to a particular beat. We sing certain songs. We eat certain types of foods that he might not like. We're going to have to buy we're going to have to buy more hot sauce, gochujang, and all that kind of sriracha sauce. If he comes on board, is he really going to fit into our ark? So maybe there's another ark down the street that's more suitable for his kind of person, his kind of people. And so we develop this idea that churches are places where you run away and hide, and that's not what the gospel is about. And God says in Jeremiah 29, you don't have that option. You don't have the option of running away and hiding. Even if you're in the midst of Babylon, you do not have the option of running away and hiding. Now, I say this now. Back then, that's what happened. The danger is it's happening again in the 21st century. Here's the things that's changing. It's not just African Americans migrating from the south to the north. It's not just Eastern and Southern Europeans migrating into the urban centers. Now there is an influx of Latinos and Asians and African Americans more and more into our urban communities and into our society as a whole. In 1965, we look at the next slide. In 1965, there was a change in the immigration laws in our country. Prior to 1965, there were clear laws that said we don't want certain types of people in our country. Something called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Can you guess what that did? No, that's pretty obvious. You excluded Chinese people. Come on, it's not that hard to think. In other words, they were pretty blatant about what they were trying to do. They called it the Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese people from the United States. So there was a series of these acts that said we only want certain types of people in the United States. But 1965 changes that. It's not that we had this unlimited immigration. There are still quotas and limitations on who gets to come into the U.S., but now the distribution of that immigration has changed. And it opens the door for particularly Asian and Latino immigration, and you get the influx of non-white immigrants from 1965 forward. So much so that by 2008, the third of the U.S. population is already over the minority number. So a third of the population is of non-European descent. The next number is very critical. By 2011, half of the births in America already passed that threshold. So even now, that number keeps getting higher and higher. We're not going backwards on that number. Half of the births in the U.S. are over the 50% mark are of non-European descent. And that points to the 2023 number, which says that half of the children in the United States by 2023 are going to be of non-European descent, which means by 2042, half of all of the U.S. population is going to be of non-European descent. And those three numbers are linked together. 2011, 2023, 2042, those numbers are linked. When your birth rate goes over 50%, the children number is going to go over 50%, and eventually the number of all Americans are going over 50%. You understand that it's tied to birth rates, meaning no matter how big of a wall Donald Trump gets Mexico to build for us, it could be the most amazing, incredible wall. It'll be a great wall. It'll be the most best wall we've ever had. No matter how big of a wall we get Mexico to build for us, we are going to have a multi-ethnic America. It's a done deal. Because this ethnic diversity is not tied to immigration. It's tied to birth rates. And that's a done deal already. In other words, deal with it. This is a multi-ethnic America. This is the reality of our present and our future. So as we deal with this reality, this truth that we are living in a diverse America, now some of us can say, well, we're afraid of that and we need to run and hide. Or we can say, thanks be to God, because we asked for the harvest and God brought the harvest right into our neighborhood. Thanks be to God. And that's why when we think we have the option of running away and hiding, we have to realize that is not an option for us. The second option, and I think I forgot to put the Bible verse on here. It comes from verse 8 and following. It gives you the idea that Jeremiah writes to the exile and says, you are not to take on the practices of the Babylonians. You're not to use their magic formulas. the practice of divination, their false prophets and idols, you are not to take on the practices. In other words, the first option, you are not allowed to give up. The second option, you are not allowed to give in and say that the practices of the world and culture around us are the practices they're going to take up. You can't give in to the world around you. Now, I raise this because there's been an interesting trend in urban ministry over the last 10, 20 years. Now, the churches that left the city a century ago moved out into the suburbs. And it was a very amazing story because these churches followed the population movement. So when whites left the city and you went to a community, and you know this story, a suburban town that had nothing there but cornfields, and then 5 years later, somebody, developer comes in and builds up this 50,000 member community, and there's a Target and a super Whole Foods and all these things and a yoga place and all these different places open up. And overnight, seemingly, within 5 years, you go from a zero population to 50,000 people living in a bedroom community outside of Minnesota. Happened all the time in the latter part of the 20th century. Now, what happened? Not just was there a white flight of population, there was a white flight of churches. And a shrewd entrepreneurial pastor says, I'm going to go out into the suburbs and plant a church. And he or she is the first one out into that community, plants a church, and the church grows because the community went from zero to 50,000. The church grows from zero to 5,000 because people are looking for a church. So that pastor has grown a church from zero to 5,000 in 5 years because the neighborhood has also grown. And of course, that pastor writes a book, How to Grow Your Church from Zero to 5,000 in 5 Years. And they tell you it's because we had clean bathrooms and nice parking lots and ushers who wore really nice hats. That's why our church grew in those 5 years. And so you develop a methodology of church growth that's rooted not in the scripture, but in the patterns and habits and practices of the world. Now, here's the other tricky part of this story. With all the success in the suburbs, these churches decide, look at that poor inner city neighborhood. Look at that Babylon city. We got to go and save those poor folk. So let's take these suburban church models and just replant them in the inner city neighborhoods. After all, we had worked out here in the suburbs. Look at us. We grew a church from zero to 5,000 in 5 years. We're going to just use the same pattern of behavior and do the same thing in the urban neighborhoods. In other words, it's Christian gentrification. So we end up following the patterns of the world, developing models of success, developing models of church growth that are just as worldly as any Fortune 500 company's plan to grow their companies. And so we have developed these two patterns that have said we're either going to give up and run away and hide, or we're going to give in to the patterns of the world, when actually what God is calling us is the practice of lament. The practice of lament. And Lamentations moves us into that practice, not to go out and run away and hide, or not to go out and fix the world, but to say, are you as a people of God entering into the space of lament? I'm going to give you two key characteristics of lament that I think we can enter into as the people of God. The first characteristic of lament, and we can see it on the next slide, is that Lamentations chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 4 follow a pattern of biblical literature called the funeral dirge. I'm just going to put stuff up here if you want the slides for this. My book has a much more thorough discussion of this. But what we do know of the book of Lamentations is that chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 4 are written as a funeral dirge. Now, what you need to know is that a typical lament in the Psalms, for example, those laments are really more like hospital visits. Someone is sick. You go, you hold their hand, and you pray with them. And as you hold their hand, you pray that they're going to get better. You lament with them in their suffering. And there is a chance and a great possibility in a hospital visit that that person is going to get better. So a lament in the Psalms typically can operate like a hospital visit. Lamentations 1, 2, and 4 are not hospital visits. They're funeral dirges. And you do not treat a dead body the same way you deal with a sick body that is in a hospital. Part of the problem of dealing with racial justice in America is that we think we're sick when our bodies are dead. We've got to deal with the dead bodies in the room. We can't just say, oh, we're going to join hands, sing kumbaya, and pour a little oil, and everything's going to be okay after all. We've had a black president. We're all good now. We're going to have a wonderful time together and just join hands and sing. That is not what's happening in our society. We can't treat a dead body in the room the same way you deal with a sick body in a hospital. Now, here's why that's so difficult to grasp. Because the dead bodies in the room are the dead bodies of black men and women. And we have to deal with that inequality. That the dead bodies in our history are more likely to be red dead bodies, brown dead bodies, and more likely to be black dead bodies than any other race. And we have to deal with that history. Because if we're not, then we're not dealing with the reality of what lament looks like. Deal with the dead bodies in the room. We have to understand that at the start of the slave trade, we had scores of dead bodies. That even as the bodies were captured and brought to the west coast of Africa, they were kept in these slave castles. And they were intentionally built like tombs. You're putting bodies into the tombs. They were separated out, male, female, father, mother, children and their parents, husbands and their wives. Everything that they were as a human being, identified as made in the image of God, the slave traders did everything to rip that apart, to take away their identity, to take away their value and worth as husband, father, mother, daughter, son. All of that was ripped apart, and they were put into those slave castles that were intentionally built to feel like tombs. One of the very first slave traders was Prince Henry of Portugal. And Prince Henry of Portugal pulls up to the coast of Africa, and his main secretary, or the historian, is named Zurara. There is an account of Zurara writing down one of these early moments in church in slave trading. And he looks down and he sees and he writes, "My tears wet the page of the report I am writing." Because he sees the inhumanity. He sees the horrible, horrible sin of taking human beings into slavery. And he says, "This is wrong." So his tears wet the very pages that he's documenting the story. But he writes and he says, "I'm still going to go along with this injustice." And he gives two reasons. The first is that my leader is Prince Henry, and he's a godly man, so he must be doing a godly thing. And he says, the second thing is, in order to prove his godliness, when the slaves are taken, he takes a tenth of the slaves and offers it to the priests that are on the ship, and the church accepts that tithe. So that at the very beginning of the slave trade, the church was right there, culpable, responsible, and giving a blessing to that slave trade. We are responsible for those dead bodies from the beginning and inception of that slave trade. We can't say we have no responsibility. We were there as the church at that moment when the slave trade started. The bodies are thrown into the hull of the ship. They're laid like dead bodies, as you know, many of these images, side by side. They're thrown side by side to mimic as if they're dead, because everything that the slave traders try to do, kill their identity as human beings, destroy their identity as ones made in the image of God. And so they did everything to destroy that identity. As they're making their way across the ocean, many who would be allowed to come up to the deck of the ship would make a run for it and dive over the side. Dead bodies would get thrown over the side. It is very well documented that schools of sharks would follow along, because they knew an easy meal would be coming over at any minute, and that bodies would come flying over. Dead bodies, dead black bodies, would be easy food for the sharks that followed these ships. They would pull up to the east coast of the colonies in the United States. They would pull up into these ports that many of us even now would be able to visit and see. They would pull up to these ports, and if it were on a Sunday, they would ring the bell, the auction bell, saying it's time to auction off human bodies. And then the church bells would ring saying, "Service is over. Praise God from whom all blessings flow." And as soon as that service was over, the very people that just sang glory to God would march down to the pier and, along with the auction bell, claim human bodies for their own possessions. The very same people that worship God would worship the auction bell and come and claim human bodies for themselves. These bodies will be taken onto the plantation, as we know, the brutal treatment of slave bodies on the plantation. It was particularly brutal for men, but I want to emphasize the brutal treatment of women on these plantations. It was one of the ways to control the slave population was control the family, or actually destroy the family. So every effort, as I mentioned earlier, was made to destroy any human family construct available to the black family. But the African slaves would say, we want to restore that social fabric by rebuilding the families. So they weren't allowed to marry in the traditional sense of the word. So they would have ceremonies like jumping the broom, which is still done to this day, because the actual ceremony was denied them. So they created ceremonies of their own, like jumping the broom, to demonstrate we are still going to be a family. We're still going to rebuild our society in this world. But the slave owner would find out about it. And the last thing he wanted was a healthy slave society. The last thing he wanted was healthy slave families. So he would go down to the slave quarters, and he would make sure that his henchmen would hold down the husband, and he would systematically engage in sexual abuse and rape of the woman to show, I'm the lord of this property. And he would destroy that family. And he would destroy that family with a systematic action of rape and sexual abuse on the plantation. This was the act of atrocious human sinfulness. And we can't deny the dead bodies. That's why I get so upset when I hear television commentators talking about what's wrong with the black family. Why can't the black family get it together? The fault of our society is the black family. The black family is a miracle. The black family is a gift from God. We have spent 500 years as a nation trying to destroy the black family. Don't tell me there's a problem with the black family. God has preserved the black family. We need to honor the work of God in preserving the black family. We need to know this history, that there are dead bodies in our history. And when we skip over these dead bodies in our history, we are not entering into the deep lament that is necessary. When we think about something like Ferguson, and what we saw in Ferguson, that Ferguson was not an accident, that God brings a renewal and revival of understanding race relations in America through particularly Ferguson, St. Louis, Missouri. Most of you know that Missouri was brought into our nation as part of the Missouri Compromise. It was done so that slavery could continue in the United States. It balanced the vote so that the number of slave states would now be equal to the number of free states, and Missouri was the slave state that was brought in. So Missouri, by its very entrance into the Union, was saying, black lives do not matter. St. Louis is also the place where the Dred Scott decision was handed down by the federal court. Dred Scott was a freed slave who claimed his freedom, but was told later, because you're a black person, you don't have those rights. In other words, he was told, your black body, your black life does not matter. In other words, we have said over and over throughout history that black lives do not matter. That's why it is so offensive when you replace Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter. It is offensive. And it is ignorant because you don't know your history. There has never, ever been a moment in American history where we have said as a nation, all lives do not matter. Point to me one place in American history where we have said, all lives do not matter. We have said for 500 years, black lives do not matter. So the answer is not all lives matter. The answer is black lives are matter because the history has said otherwise. We have to deal with the dead bodies in the room. We have to deal with this history. Lament not only deals with the truth of history, lament also calls for all the voices to be heard. The Book of Lamentations is phenomenal because there's a question about who wrote it. Now, as I mentioned, all the authors and literary folks and those who had maybe the capacity to read and write, they were sent away into exile. The only one who actually was left behind was Jeremiah. Jeremiah, if you read the book of Jeremiah, will repeatedly say to Jerusalem, give in to Babylon. So the Babylonians thought he was on their side. So they allowed Jeremiah to stay behind. So in terms of a candidate for who could actually write the Book of Lamentations, Jeremiah might be one of the very few candidates who could write a book like this. At the same time, critics and scholars of the Bible have looked at the writing style of Lamentations, compared it to the writing style of his other works, Jeremiah, and say that can't be. The writing style is too different. It sounds like two different people who are speaking in the book of Jeremiah and who's speaking in the book of Lamentations. Well, what's happening is, after the fall of Jerusalem, Jeremiah, who again might be one of the very few people who could read or write, goes to the town gate, with the city gate, and all those who had been suffering, particularly the women, the children, the orphans, and the widows, and they start telling their stories. And Jeremiah begins to tell their story, not his own. He tells the story of those who have suffered. In other words, his voice, the voice you hear in Lamentations, is not the voice of the privileged. It is the voice of the oppressed. And if there's something we need to do better in urban ministry, is not to just emphasize the voice of the privileged. We've got to hear the voice of the oppressed. We've got to hear from the voice of the suffering. Those are the voices that rise up in the book of Lamentations. Now, I mentioned this because there are oftentimes places in our urban ministry where certain voices are privileged over and against other voices. I'll give you this illustration. When I was living on the East Coast, we had a different way of relating. And as a Korean, I have a different way of relating. Koreans are very passionate people, as some of you know. When we get into something, we really get into something. If you go to a prayer mountain in Korea, there's literally no grass on the ground, because when we pray, we tear apart grass and throw them over our shoulders. That's how intense we are. There's a Korean-American comedian talking about how Koreans answer the phone. Yeoseo! Annyeonghaseyo! That's how we say hello. That's, hey, what's up? That's how we say that. So there is a passion within the Korean community that comes out naturally. And I think I might have demonstrated for the last half hour that Koreans get passionate about things. Now that's just, I think, cultural, that's my personality, but there's a certain way that I relate in meetings and person to person, in sermons, that comes out of my passion, and I think a lot of that has to do with my Korean-American identity. Now, when I came from the East Coast to the Midwest, I discovered not everybody has that Korean passion. I discovered it when I was speaking in Minnesota, and I was told that there's not quite the same way of relating in Minnesota. I was introduced to a concept called Minnesota Nice. Now, I had never heard of that before, and I think it's just Minnesota Nice, but just Midwest Nice in general. I said, so what is Minnesota Nice? And a nice Minnesota person explained it to me. Imagine a big friendly dog comes up to you, puts his paws on your shoulder, he's licking your face and peeing on your shoes at the same time. That's Minnesota Nice. Now, what I've been told is that Minnesota Nice is an appropriate way to show anger. So in a faculty meeting, those who exhibit Minnesota Nice are the ones that are listened to. But when I get into my Korean passion, then my voice is silenced because I'm outside of the box. So there are ways that we hear certain things because we privilege certain voices. So when someone comes and says, I don't know, that's an angry group. You know, that's an angry black group. I don't know if we want them at our meeting. What if, you know, that's an angry Korean group. I don't know. Well, you know, too much kimchi. Something's wrong with them. You know, we can't have them at our gatherings. How are we going to conduct the meeting? Well, you're policing the tone. When actually it might be a culturally derived or a sociologically derived type of preference. So is Minnesota Nice any less angry than Korean passion? I don't think so. I think they're both pretty angry. And in a good way and in a bad way. But how do we hear each other? How are all the voices heard? How are all the voices embraced? And that's what I love about the book of Lamentations. It calls us to hear the voices from the entire community. In fact, one of the most amazing things is the close of Lamentations chapter 5, and I'll close with this passage. Lamentations chapter 5 moves not only towards Jeremiah telling the world what the people of God are suffering in Jerusalem. But Lamentations 5 clearly is when the people begin to pray for themselves. And it is the most amazing prayer, because the people who had once been disempowered, who had once been marginalized and ostracized and told that they had nothing to give, nothing to offer, now their voices rise up front and center. And if there's one thing we can say about the racial justice issue, about the social justice issue, about urban ministry, the best thing we can do is raise up the voice of the marginalized. Amen. We can point the gospel towards that community and says, you can now speak for yourselves. You can now raise up a cry. I don't pray on your behalf. You pray to God directly. We want to give that dignity for those individuals who have been told they have no dignity. You can now rise up and pray for yourselves. Lamentations 5 does just that. So I'm going to close my session with reading Lamentations 5. But I'm going to do it through the grid of the dead bodies in our nation's history. I wrote this right after I visited Ferguson. I visited Ferguson not that long after the non-indictment came on Officer Lewis, and we gathered as about 50 Christian leaders in St. Louis to talk about what we can do as a Christian community. Very diverse community, leaders from all across the nation, across the ethnic spectrum. We gathered to talk about these issues, and we were feeling pretty good. We spent 2 or 3 days brainstorming, meeting leaders, meeting the church leaders, and we felt pretty good, and we're starting to think about an action plan of what we were going to do next. And as we were having our final session and we were putting all these ideas on the whiteboard and all these oak tags and they were putting them all over the room, everybody's phone starts going off, buzzing and beeping. And everybody looks at their phones, and the non-indictment of Eric Garner had just come out. And everybody started looking at their phones and trembling. One of the youngest members of our gathering was a young African-American in his mid-20s. He was about probably the same size, 6'4", about 300 pounds as Michael Brown. Everybody starts freaking out over this non-indictment, but he especially is really affected by it, and he rushes out into the hallway. We try to continue to have this meeting, but then we hear this wailing, this weeping, this crying out. This young man, the 25-year-old, was out there in the hallway weeping and wailing. And he starts saying, they had video. They had video. How could they not even indict? And he started saying, why would I ever bring children into a world like this? Why would I ever bring a black child into this world when I know his future might be just like Eric Garner or Michael Brown? And as he wailed, there were about 4 or 5 older African-American women who gathered around him. And they knew the pain of loss. They knew what it was like to believe that their son had been killed or harassed or stopped or to be worried. And they gathered around this young man and they prayed as a lament over him. No words were spoken, just tears and prayers and cries of lament were offered. And then the rest of us, all 50 of us, gathered together around this young man to pray in lament. Our job is not to run away and hide from the world out there. Our job is not to give in to the world, but our job is to offer up a lament on behalf of the suffering. Let me read for you now Lamentations chapter 5. Remember, Lord, what happened to Michael Brown and Eric Garner. Look and see the disgraceful way they treated their bodies. Our inheritance of the image of God in every human being has been co-opted and denied by others. The children of Eric Garner have become fatherless. Widow mothers grieve their dead children. We must scrap for our basic human rights. Our freedom and our liberty has a great price. Corrupt officers and officials pursue us and are at our heels. We are weary and we find no rest. We submitted to uncaring government agencies and to big businesses just to get enough bread. Our ancestors sinned the great sin of instituting slavery. They are no more, but we bear their shame. The system of slavery and institutionalized racism ruled over us, and there is no one to free us from their hands. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the guns on the streets. Michael Brown's skin is as hot as an oven as his body lay out in the blazing sun. Women have been violated throughout our nation's history. Black women raped by white slave owners on the plantations. Noble black men have been hung, lynched, and gunned down. Elders and spokesmen are shown no respect. Young men can't find work because of the unjustly applied laws. Boys stagger under the expectation that their lives are destined for jail. The elder statesmen and civil rights leaders are gone from the city gate. Young people who speak out at their protests through music are silenced. And trust in our ultimate triumph has diminished. Our triumphant dance has turned to a funeral dirge. Our sense of exceptionalism has been exposed. Woe to us, Lord, for we have sinned. Because of this, our hearts are faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim. For our cities lie desolate, with predatory lenders and real estate speculators prowling all over them. You, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures from generation to generation. Why do you forget us? Why do you forsake us for so long? Restore us to yourself, Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure.